फिर से करो.
In every heartbeat of life, there's a story.
It kind of really bursts a meta-level myth that somehow our eating habits are carefully curated.
With each shared experience, there is an invitation to each one of you to introspect, to question, how does this resonate with me?
Journalists say cancer cured. They say, no, we've accelerated the path to the future where we find a cure.
Join us as we dive into tales that feel written from the pages of our own lives.
A lot of Indians, when they hear anything in Sanskrit, they just think it is something holy. Point where you've been so coddled, your mind has been so coddled that you've never had your beliefs challenged.
Reflect on each narrative and ponder how these tales mirror your own journey. Because in every shared story, there's a spark waiting to ignite your own path of personal transformation. This is Saujanya, your host, welcoming you to our new series, The Change Catalyst, from Attitude Makeover. So welcome back to Attitude Makeover, a podcast where we venture into personal transformation and self-discovery. Today's episode strikes at the heart of our ethos. As we traverse through this unique journey with my guest, Chris Ashok, someone who debunks the myth around food, and he's the face behind Masala Lab. In this conversation, I wanted to see if we can draw a parallel between debunking food to debunking our own beliefs. Beliefs which are shaped not just by our own personal experiences, but also by cultural and societal layers, if I can call it that. In today's conversation, I'd like to see if we can aim to understand and perhaps in some way also redefine the framework of our convictions itself. Chris, I think this is going to be a very promising, enlightening conversation. Welcome on board to Attitude Makeover. Totally thrilled to have you here. How are you today?
Pleasure being here. Good, good. I've been lots of travel here and there, but it's been a crazy last few months, to be honest. I had no idea that debunking and so on would suddenly sort of become such a rare thing, if you will. And then all of a sudden, with 500 million Instagram followers, I had absolutely no idea. For someone who would never used Instagram 2 years ago, I think it's been a very bizarre and surreal sort of ride.
I always start my podcast with my audience getting a glimpse of my guest, because at the core of it, there's a value that binds us all together. And I think a better way to really get to know my guests is to let them speak about their early years. Would you mind going through your early years, walking us through that, to just give us a glimpse of who's Chris?
So the first interesting thing is that I think as a South Indian, the father's name comes first, so we have no surname. So my name is Ashok, right? But then, I've been called Krish all my life. So I think, I've gotten used to it now. So again, I grew up in a South Indian sort of Tamil family, and that lived all over India. And so in a strange sense, lived in Delhi, lived in Bombay, lived in Bangalore, and my father before he got married, he was in Calcutta. So very much a very pan-Indian kind of family with very, obviously, very strong opinions about which is the best place to live and, which are the most nicest place and so on. And I grew up with younger siblings, two boys. We were three boys. And so you can imagine how nightmarish life was for our mother. And she was working as well. I think a big part of our upbringing was the fact that we largely were brought up by my grandmother, paternal grandmother, and who's a beautiful storyteller. The upbringing largely was a mix of multiple cities, multiple places, and constantly changing friends, and constantly revisiting any hard beliefs and any ideas and stereotypes that you have. Right, you have a stereotype about Delhi, and Delhi breaks those stereotypes. You have a stereotype about Mumbai, and Mumbai breaks those stereotypes. And I think the more languages you speak, the more diverse your friends and And the less you are constantly told this, what you do is the best, your food, what you eat is the best, and this is the greatest, etc. I think there is always a certain sense of epistemic humility the moment you travel. In that sense, my job again ended up doing the same thing. I was in TCS. So 1 year in TCS, I had a visa. I was in the US. I lived there for 7 years and in San Antonio, Texas, and so on. So in that sense, I think it's been a usual yet unique in small ways, you know, like with my grandmother being a storyteller and largely an atheist and so on.
No, this is beautiful. I can actually relate with quite a few things, whether it is learning multiple languages and really having a broader spectrum of people you interact with, thereby sort of, you know, debunking some of these myths, because you assume growing up that, Bangalore means this. How do you sort of identify which myth do you want to navigate through? And how do you navigate between a genuine societal feedback to a transient opinion? I think the reason this is important is I feel, especially in a transformative journey, sometimes we've grown up saying, hey, I'm a very shy person, or I'm very bad with numbers, and so on and so forth. And then we start building stories around that for ourselves on, you know, in 10th standard, I did this, and this is where, you know, it's been, I've always been bad at this. But that's not the reality. And there is a methodology, I believe, that you probably have nailed very early on in identifying which myth is more regional versus which myth applies to a larger spectrum, and then going into the depth of it. So my question is, how do you go about identifying which myth you want to debunk?
It first has to come from a place where if you see yourself as a crusader who is bringing light to darkness, I think that's the wrong way to think about this. Because I think, you know, one of the earliest things I imbibed was probably, so, you know, for example, my grandmother would tell me that there is no one Ramayana, that there was actually every 100 kilometers, the story changes. The overarching arc may be the same, but actually if you look at the entire subcontinent and if you include Sri Lanka and so on, you have every possible variation of the story.
Yeah.
There are feminist versions of the Mahabharata, Ramayana, right? Which are very stole from a Sita-centric point of view in some of the tribal communities, in the more matrilineal communities, where the story is told from Sita's perspective and of, Rama, Lord Rama actually being not really a nice husband and so on. And she looking for seeing and walking away from him and then there is a Ravana-centric view that says that all he did was to provide some sort of shelter for this woman who wanted to leave, but then ended up having that entire edifice being burnt down by an army of monkeys. So the point is that, you know, but it's interesting. If I go tell the story in Varanasi, it will really offend people. It will absolutely offend people, and rightfully so, because I think... So the weird thing is that the human species is one of those... like all mammals, we're actually trapped in a brain that is built on storytelling. In fact, storytelling is just a natural outcome of the way our neurons are wired, actually, right? Yeah. We are a pattern matching illusion, constantly fall for fallacies and illusions. And the ways our brains are built for storytelling are all things that helped us survive in the savannas 10,000 years ago. And it is just that we have so rapidly moved from that into people who need to do analytical engineering in order to succeed. It's a tremendous pressure. It's a tremendous stress we don't quite recognize that it takes an extraordinarily unnatural, inhuman amount of effort to get past that idea of how you form beliefs and how you need to somehow erase your beliefs once in a while. Part of the reason why the scientific method delivered so much in the last 200 years is not because scientists were geniuses and we made these amazing things, but no, the deeper psychological insight is that group of people figured out a way to let their egos do less damage than it would otherwise have.
Yeah.
I did this research, Einstein saying, no, the universe does not expand.
Yeah.
Absolutely was happy to say that one completely unknown scientist showed data that the universe does expand. And he said, yeah, I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Right. So it takes a tremendous to say I'm wrong to 50 years of your research and fame and celebrity and all of that. And yet the edifice of science is built on the fact that scientists criticizing each other in a formal academic setting, it's not personal.
Yeah.
It's science. Yeah. That is peer review. You expect your thing to be brutally sort of, you know, looked at by others and questioned. Yeah. And that's how knowledge moves forward, and as opposed to just the scientist moving forward, right? But unfortunately, if you look at how the public looks at it, public does not remember the maybe 100,000 or so people whose research might have been required over the last 50 years to make Chandrayaan happen.
True. Right?
You ask everyone, they'll just remember Somnath, who was basically the administrator who was there on TV and just stood next to the prime minister. And in a pure engineering sense, may have actually played very little role in that entire endeavor. Right? But that's just, so that whole additive sense of that is always, so the, I think the thing is that forming beliefs, I think, is just a natural human thing. And so when it comes to food, which is so central, so deep, and like as I say, it's the only foreign object you willingly put into your body every single day, and you somehow trust that it will not poison you, right? And so obviously it's natural that people have deep-seated fears, and they want to hold on to certain beliefs, and it is also quite logical for them to hold on to beliefs that they believe have been around for the longest amount of time. Yeah.
What I want to go a little more deeper here. There are multiple myths, right? There are myths that are very unique to the case that you talked about. Like, I've had lived experiences, and based on that, I've had a point of view or belief over here. And that is very strong because of my lived experiences. There are others which are like a little more spread out. And the impact is like, you know, sort of universal. It's not across, but then it goes beyond a particular state, it goes beyond a particular district to across India sort of thing, or a cultural thing.
Yes.
So how do you pick which myths do I want to go after? Is it just intuition, or is there some process that you follow there?
So intuition often is just is an abstract way of not answering the question about what is ultimately pattern matching, or slightly, shall I say, probabilistic or statistical thinking. Right? People will call it intuition, but effectively it's really that, right? In a sense, I think the longer you are in the public domain and on social media, and you're also, you're responding to people, you're responding to comments, you're responding to DMs. And therefore you have more sample data to extract patterns about this seems to be a more pervasive belief than something else. Like for instance, the pattern that you observe that, I know, for instance, that pressure cooker will destroy nutrients is a strong North Indian myth. Nobody in the South and East really has a problem, because my great-grandmother was using a pressure cooker. Right? Rice cultures have been using pressure cookers for the longest time. Right? So again, it's a natural thing that any newfangled device is always going to be met with resistance. It's the same thing that North India is kind of going through, etc. But the only problem is that in the past, anybody who believed pressure cooker was bad in North India never had an opportunity to speak to a South Indian who was using the pressure cooker, right? You know, physical distance, no internet, no Zoom, all of that. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's on the same platform, and everybody's like confused all the time, right? Because nobody's able to look at a content and say, ah, this is coming from this place and this context and this thing, right? So the first layer is often very deeply personal, and I don't like, you know, garam masala in this is a belief, okay? And people will say, people will generalize that to, no, you must not add garam masala to anything, you know, in that level. And then there are caste-specific ideas, you know, so caste and religion, community-centric. You must not add onion and garlic to this. You must not add mushrooms. Mushrooms are veg, non-veg. Eggs are veg, non-veg. Those kind of layer of beliefs around that. Then there are national level beliefs where Indians will say that food is bland, this food is tasteless, and they are mixing. Italians are mixing fish and dairy, which is bad, and so on. So the thing is that I think people, these beliefs often have like layers from the individual to the family to the, especially when it comes to food and nutrition, money, many layers exist. So therefore, I think, for example, I would say that if I'm speaking about pressure cooker, it might actually make sense to do that reel in Hindi, because I most of my South Indian would be like, well, people have a problem with pressure cookers. And sometimes when I do pick these up, a lot of South Indians will be like, oh, I had no idea this was a problem.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, yes, because you never had Instagram before, you never had exposure to 200 billion North Indians all shouting on the same platform. Right.
Yeah.
You never had that world before. And then now, so that's the, so in that sense, it's largely about a sense of what might be trending, what people tend to believe. And in a weird way, the food world, the easiest way to find this is that all our terrible mainstream media is forever daily looking for content, and they just pick up the worst misinformation and amplify it on a daily basis. And that, unfortunately, is again confusing people. Right? The worst purveyors of misinformation are not influencers. It's the Times of India and everyone else who just blindly takes that some random influencer's content and beams it to and prints it in the newspaper and without any review, fact check, nothing.
Yeah.
Right? Sabudana is nutritious. Apparently, I have no idea when it became nutritious. But yeah, there are 6 reasons why Sabudana will prevent menopause.
Yeah.
It's just starch. How on earth is it going to prevent menopause, right? And why would any food prevent menopause? I mean, that's a separate existential question to ask. But in general, I think, you know, it is just that you can generally sort of use these methods to look and see what is largely this. And in a sense, also, there is a second level to this, right? One is that the best ones are usually where I myself may have believed it at some point, and I really worked hard to change my mind on it. And so it is easier for me to now explain that to people without judgment.
Yeah.
For why you are believing it, because I absolutely believed it in it at some point too, right?
Yeah.
And almost always, I think that's usually the sort of way to do this. But again, that said, you know, if anyone bothers to read the comment section, it will all seem like the world is on fire, right? Because that's just the nature of social media, because it just brings extremes, people with extreme beliefs to come and argue with each other, because it increases the amount of time people spend on these apps, right? So yeah, so in general, as I said, you know, never read the comment sections, right? It's a terrible idea. Yeah.
No, I think what is interesting for me is, see, at the age of, in my 40s, I've now come to understand, when you're going through personal transformation especially, there are 4 aspects that sort of come together. There is the mind, the body, the social you, and the inner you. The inner you is the one which does a lot of introspection, spirituality, etc. But we sort of tend to forget the play of the mind and the body, especially the body. I remember watching your video on Sabudana, and I love Sabudana, and someone who's been going through this IBS issues, I was like, oh wow, I thought it was very healthy. And till I actually watched your video, and I was like, really?
and it's an eye-opening
thing.
It isn't even what it says it is. That's the best part, right? Yes. Because of the state of hand that somehow sago used to refer to this thing from a palm tree, sago palm, is just now the ultra-processed version of the same thing from tapioca, which is a root underground that came from Africa and was introduced to Kerala, right, and Tamil Nadu. Mm. And people don't eat Sabudana in the south. But all Sabudana is manufactured in the south.
Yes, yes.
It kind of really bursts a meta-level myth that somehow our eating habits are carefully curated products of our grandmothers and great-grandmothers and everyone wisely picking and selecting and rejecting things over time based on whether it's healthy or not. Right? Yeah. And the reality is, no, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
Massive moments of history shape some of our eating habits. 80% of what we eat today, Indians were not eating 200 years ago. Carrots and cabbage and cauliflower, all were vegetables introduced by the British and the Portuguese. Chilies, there were no chilies in India before 200 years ago. Tomatoes, no potatoes. And not only that, the shaping of habits from eating local millets to eating rice and wheat largely is a function of the British setting up a ration system where they would, for food safety, they would only buy up wheat and rice and store them and then give it to people when there was a famine and other things. And we just inherited that system, right?
Yeah.
All the stuff about millets, nobody's going to eat millets unless you get it in the ration shop, right?
Yeah.
So because you get that, with that poverty, the state has to make that investment and so on. So, and the Chinese addiction to opium ultimately drove tea addiction in India are all like flukes of history, right?
I think this leads to a very important part where you mentioned about history. Now, as part of your personal transformation journey, one of the things I believe is really important is for one to go back to your past and really reflect on patterns in your past, and sort of see does it still hold good in your present, or do you have to redefine and reshape it? You know, and it's a very powerful tool. It's a very laborious one, intentional one, but nonetheless a very important one. And what I'm also understanding from you in your process of debunking myth is that one that really stood out as to, wow, I didn't think of this.
Yeah. So it happens all the time. So the thing is that exploring the past is actually exploring the past is a nice thing to do that everyone does, right? But exploring your past with humility and full transparency and without bias is very hard to do, because it takes you down very, very uncomfortable routes, right? And you have to be able to confront that, because I think it's easier for us to say our ancestors were great. They were amazing. They did everything, right? And it's also easy for the country to believe that, oh, we knew everything, but the British and the Mughals took it all away. And right? And so a lot of people sometimes have trouble accepting that the story is told by people in my family that this is the noble way to eat. There is no cruelty involved to animals and so on. And you kind of blindly accept that. And because you were all in cities, you never quite realize the fact that, well, milk is pretty cruel. You have to keep a cow pregnant for 10 years, non-consensual, right? And then somebody in my college asking me, if you guys are drinking milk, why would you not eat eggs, right? So to get milk, you have to non-consensually keep a cow pregnant for 10 years. To get eggs, you have to prevent a hen from getting pregnant, which is more moral, yeah. Right? If you ask the cow and the cow will gladly be a hen. Right? Why would you want to go through back-to-back pregnancies for like 10 years? Whereas all you have to do in a poultry farm is to keep the rooster away. And the hen will lay an egg once a month. Right? Originally once a month. Nowadays, the artificially selected breeds lay once a day. Right? I know. I mean, it sounds weird, but well, the egg is the hen's period.
Yeah.
Right? So it struck me only in my 20s that, oh, okay. So why is egg not vegetarian? Right? And here's the other... So then you kind of also then realize that there is no food production without cruelty, right? You can arbitrarily draw a line and say, because we are animals, and it's somehow very hard to see another thing which can make a sound, which has eyes, to be killed, right? And slaughtered for just so you can eat. That's visceral. And you can understand why people would have a problem with that, right? But how do you think rice is grown? How do you think... So at a philosophical level, one is that you're also assuming that we are an animal, so I am biased towards animals. I don't want them to die. Plants are another form of life. I have convinced myself that they don't feel pain and suffering in the way I do. Right? It's just that plants do not want to be killed. So, but they don't move. They don't have nerves. But they use other mechanisms. They use poisons. They produce. Why does an onion make you cry? Right? Why does a chili burn in your mouth? This is basically the plant's way of saying, don't eat me, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I think, you know, so leave that aside. You can even say, fine, you know what? I have a hierarchy. That the lines that people draw that around morality and all of that are also, they're just things that stories that they tell themselves because they want to feel good about their choices. And not because they're based in some sort of rational, this thing. It's a story we sort of tell ourselves, right? And then, you know, there's another interesting thing. You have a, to when you're eating chicken, well, you know, a family, one chicken loses its life. All right? When you eat a bowl of rice, millions of rats, millions of rabbits, millions of squirrels, millions of birds, millions of worms all had to be brutally killed by pesticides, herbicides, and knives and other things so that human beings can unnaturally grow one species of plant over an acre. There is nothing natural about a field of paddy, because nature would like to grow 100 things and build ecosystems and worms. Things interdepend on each other. That's not how agriculture works. You need to subvert nature and say, here is a patch of land, a patch of earth, where I will grow something and I will grow only this one thing. I will not let any other form of life anywhere near there just so I can eat. So it is just that, yes, you are not killing, you know, a rat directly, but the collective effect of... deforestation as a result of any kind of plant agriculture is immense amounts of violence, right? So if you're a vegan, you somehow have to tell yourself, well, I'm not directly causing that. Right? And so therefore, I'm more moral. Now I will go shout at someone who's posting about egg and say, "You did you know these hens are put in cages?" I said, "Boss, okay, all food is cruelty. All food is one form of life, killing and eating another form of life, right? And we all, within the limitations of what we can or cannot do, what we can afford, what we cannot afford, assuming that the bigger morality is that we have to feed people and they cannot starve. That's more important than protecting an animal, protecting a forest, protecting, all of that is secondary.
You're multifaceted, I think, over here. I mean,
so in the sense that I think, you know, so for me, it is always like Sanskrit is a classic example of a lot of Indians, when they hear anything in Sanskrit, they just think it is something holy.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be very well like, you know, "I like drinking alcohol in evenings." It could be some random sentence. But the moment you say it in Sanskrit, it will be, people will think it's some divine thing, right? And I sort of said, people, Vedas are, they are the are spiritual, et cetera, et cetera. And I started reading some of them and some of the commentaries. And it really just struck me that Vedas were just full of animal sacrifices, as was the Mahabharata. And Rama and Sita are hunting deer and eating it like every other day. Like, so for some reason, you know, I heard from the Ramayana, when I used to ask whether Rama was vegetarian, my grandmother would say, yeah, he was. Right? Of course, he was vegetarian. But apparently, Valmiki didn't think so. Right? So my funny observation often is that Sita has like most, you know, the Bechdel rule about how representation of women in art and in movies and all of that, right? Ramayana has the same Bechdel rule applies. The few times, Sita, very few times Sita has a dialogue. Okay? And in four of those times, she's literally saying, "I want to eat venison. Please go hunt deer for me." I kid you not, right? Why do you think Ravana set Maricha to be a beautiful deer? For her to pet it? No, for her to eat it. Nobody keeps a pet deer. It's a wild animal. So it's for eating, right? So the point is that I think, you know, so the first recognition was that, oh, were our ancestors meat eating? So which brings me to the point of, when did we become vegetarian? And why did we become vegetarian? Yeah. And so you sort of then realize that none of these things are like permanent, right? The Vedas are full of animal sacrifice. Not only by animal, I mean cow and bull too. Right? It's not, they were not like saying protect the cow. You know, it begs an issue about, again, it's a regional thing, right? So then you kind of realize, so there is a history angle to it, but then there is geography. This nation is so diverse that you look, take a geographic plus history view, you realize that the Indo-Gangetic plain, large, flat, fertile places with giant amounts of pasture have historically been perfect for dairy farming. Because simple carbon footprint says that dairy is more sustainable than actually eating meat. Because then you have to kill the animal. It's much, much more energy inefficient to eat meat, right? Because you're higher up the food chain. But dairy is very efficient. You have so much pasture. You don't have to really just keep cows. They will go eat whatever. You will get milk. You can turn the milk into fat. You can turn the milk into high quality animal protein. So that is why dairy in the north and west is so central. Ghee is such a central thing. Butter and milk and paneer and all of that is so central to the north and the Gangetic plain in general, right? And again, a lot of, somehow because of the nature of India, the center of gravity is always there. Right? Mm-hmm. All other parts of edges of India are barely considered. But geographically, the south and east do not have large pasture land at all. So either coast, so there's always fishing and there are mountains right by the side. So you're not going to have large scale dairy farming. So dairy has never been a thing, except in the context of meat, in all the way from Kerala, Tamil Nadu, Odisha, Andhra Pradesh, and this entire till the northeast, right? So even right now, if you see, most vegetarians in India live in the north and west. South and east are fully meat and seafood eating, right? And by the way, North and West, significantly more lactose. So you can bring in population genetics now. North and West people are lactose, far more lactose tolerant as adults. So they can continue to drink milk in their 70s. South Indians will develop IBS if they continue to drink milk after their 40s. Okay. So it is just that. So they're all lactose intolerant, right? So you kind of then recognize that, oh, there's a geographic reason why the vast majority of people in the South and East are meat eating. I mean, and then you're like, okay, why am I in the 2% of the population that seems to be vegetarian? So it is just that I think, you know, if people often think their entire universe is just their family, and then they think it's only their community, and then okay, that they think it's only their state and linguistic pride, and then they think it's the nation, and then you kind of realize that no, it's all interconnected. And if you look far back enough, and if you go higher up enough, all your beliefs can be questioned very easily.
I think what you're also talking about is having that curiosity and that ability to question some of the fundamentals. And this is where keeping your ego aside and then going with that curious mind to see, let me understand this. And that's how opinions are built as well, isn't it? As opinions, like, influenced by others.
Well, absolutely. The weird distortion that social media creates is people share opinions, but the short form 30 second, 45 second, 90 second nature of it means that you can't give context around that opinion. Right? I can't frame it in a, like there was, I think there was a popular viral reel about how white bread is all poisonous, maida is poisonous, brown bread is a scam, that is a scam, everything is a scam. In 90 seconds, the point, again, your point you're trying to make is that they're very high in sugar, they're industrially produced, they have preservatives, and that it doesn't have any fiber, it's not made from atta. I think those are important points to make, fair enough, right? But I think what is the larger context, right? You know, who do you think eats white bread? And some of the poorest people do that because it's cheap, convenient, and if you're going to work, you think, you know, if you're a construction laborer trying to feed kids to go to school before going working in a construction, you think you're going to sit and bake what, aloo paratha in the morning? No. And if you're wheat eating, you want to buy bread and give your kids that, right? And it's fine. I mean, it's calories. Right? So there is context. So if you're someone who's at that point where you need enough calories, bread is absolutely fine. I'm assuming they're also eating egg. They're also eating meat. They're actually eating a pretty balanced meal. They're also eating this, right? So it's just that then as you kind of go up, then it just somehow becomes unposh to eat white bread and you want to eat sourdough and all of that. And what struck me about that video was the casual suggestion that stop buying all of this bread. Here is a brand you should buy. Okay. Which raises a conflict of interest issue. It, like, you know, for example, is this an advertisement for that brand? It, but anyway, the interesting thing is that the sourdough brand of bread he recommended was a half loaf at 230 rupees. How many people in India can afford a 230 rupee loaf of bread when you can get a white industrially made bread for like 15, 20 rupees? So it's just that sometimes I think, you know, the problem with the opinions and other things today is that tweets and all of these things, no context, no background, no nuance. And also, see, the interesting thing is when you write a scientific white paper, almost half of the white paper is, here's what this is not. Here are the conditions under which this research is true, right? There's a famous joke that when a scientist says, 10%, we found a method to reduce 10% of cancer cells in a rat's tail. That's the paper. Journalists say cancer cured. Is the headline. They say, no, we have not cured cancer, but we have accelerated the path to the future where we find a cure. The response to that is time travel invented. Right. So it's just, so every time the doctor is like explaining, no, the guy's keeps making even more and more astonishing, oversimplified claims. And I think the deeper introspection about how people are also forming opinions on the basis of clickbait instead of, you know, long form reading and debate and persuasion. And social media is also not exposing people to people who they might disagree with. You are forever exposed to only people you already agree with. And so that's why even now, even young people now find it so difficult when they suddenly hear things that they that they cannot agree with, right? So there's a huge sort of cancel culture, and somebody said something that I disagree with. It triggered me. I want to let's start a movement to cancel him. Let's go dox him on. And this kind of behavior now that you're seeing in the West, and you're slowly starting to see that in India, I think it's coming from that point where you've been so coddled, your mind has been so coddled that you've never had your beliefs challenged. And your echo chambers have forced you to believe, give you this false sense that everything you see is one factual and complete and all context is provided when none of that is true.
I think one thing that stood out here is also how do you, the art of debate is not something we thought about, we thought in while growing up. And that becomes crucial because when you're actually talking about some of these beliefs and you're debunking myths, people can get personal, can get very personal. And so yes. How do you stay off of that, create a context in that 90 seconds? And, you know, it comes down to really bringing out the curiosity, but also having an art of storytelling that sets the context, debunks this, and then there's a call for action as well. Did I get that right?
Yeah. In a sense, in my experience, actually, it was quite interesting. Almost 20, 25 years ago, I had an opportunity. Back then in TCS, one of the people who used to regularly advise TCS and come and speak to employees and was Edward De Bono. Six thinking hats,
Yeah.
And it always struck me that one of the things he used to say is that a debate is the worst way to learn anything. Right? Because a debate is a performative, it is a boxing match where the spectacle is on the individuals debating and not on the ideas being debated. Right? And the individual participants are coming at it from the point of view of wanting to win the debate and not necessarily to inform an audience. Right? The assumption is somehow the audience will inform itself by listening to both points of view. But he says that that's just not how it works. Because most issues are where two people debating probably agree on 80% of the things. But in a debate, you'll never hear where they agree with each other. Everyone has had their eyes sharply focused on the points of disagreement. And he said that's no way to learn anything, right? So in general, I think so. That's why he used to sort of encourage new ways of running meetings where when somebody would present something, immediately countering that is not a great idea, right? So you would say that first round, everyone, tell me what you agreed with. Let's focus only on that, right? And then let's have a round where you say, what more can be done in terms of any other data things, etc., right? More analytical. And then last one is emotionally, where did you all disagree with it? Everyone goes around. So he says that that's usually a better way because then you've gotten everything. You've gotten all the points of agreement. You've got all the avenues of improvement and all the points of disagreement, right? Which you would never get in a debate. So it's just that I think there are ways to do good debates. You can still structure a debate in a way where there is good faith and ideas are engaging with each other and not human beings, fighting with each other, right? That's the problem, right? You can't debate climate change now. You can't put one guy and say climate change is real and have another guy that says, no, climate change is not real. In 2023, you cannot do that because what you're doing? You're effectively giving the pseudoscience an equal platform. And I have no interest in doing that, right? So the point is that at a basic level, I'm not interested in elevating pseudoscience by even bothering to debate it. So therefore, in my general view, I don't target the angry, opinionated people at all. On Instagram, my target audience is people who are willing to listen and don't have strong opinions and are just general common sense and they don't have a vested interest in leaving angry. That's a tiny 1%, but it's very and every social media person makes this mistake. They focus on the angry people and the people who leave a comment. That's not the majority. You can silently do good if you can speak in a tone of language that is not patronizing. The other problem is that if you are speaking to the social media extremists, you then use a language that normal people simply don't like or recognize.
I think one thing you talked about is also sort of bringing the knowledge of the past in a present perspective mode to reshape or redefine your belief, right? Yes. There's an art and science to it.
Yes.
Do you have a moment that basically elevated your point of view over there, an old lesson that really changed that perspective for you from the historical information that you gathered to how it helped you reshape or redefine the present? Because I sort of draw an analogy again to transformation. A lot of us struggle with validation, especially people coming from an Indian culture, right? Because we are taught to seek validation either in the inner circle, like your parents, your spouse, your siblings, or your children, or in a social layer itself, your society itself. Nonetheless, validation is a huge
weird, in weird contrast to sometimes the religious scriptures we often swear by, which tell the exact opposite, to be honest, right? Absolutely. I mean, the most famous one that most Indians are familiar with is the Gita saying that, no, you must not seek validation. You must do the right thing, right? And it's weird. It's somehow, there is also a curious Indian tendency to somehow hold these contradictions in our head, right? And in a sense, I think Jugaad is a permanent state of mind. Sabudana is a classic example. My other favorite example is Asafoetida. Right. So Jains and Buddhists and Orthodox Hindus, sometime back in the day, their religious leader said, no onion garlic, right? And they were like, man, but onion garlic is dreadfully delicious. You know, I'm going to really miss it. So what do? You just bite your finger and just live through it? No. So we find this herb in Afghanistan whose root has a resin that has the exact same flavor molecules as onion and garlic. And we that is now allowed, right? So people say, I don't eat onion and garlic, but I eat asafoetida, effectively eating the same thing, right? Same flavor. Okay. So sabudana, potato, fasting food. See, scripture only said don't eat rice, wheat, and things that they existed 2000 years ago. Potato didn't exist. Sabudana didn't exist. So all foreign foods are allowed as fasting food. I find that both a unique strength as well as a weakness, to be honest. Strength because Indians are among the least susceptible to religious fundamentalism. Because we will find flexible ways to interpret anything. Okay. No, once one God, one this thing, you will do this, go kill some. That never work here. Okay. Right. Although you can see parts of that being attempted in India, but rarely makes it a pan-Indian sense of being able to do that. People are fundamentally flexible, focused on what they want to do, and they will bypass whatever rules you put around to get to where they are. You can see that in the way our traffic also works.
Yeah.
No rules, no something, but somehow it just moves, right? I mean, it's just that sort of like a very strategic, collaborative selfishness. So is what I
love the way you put it. Yeah, I think I want to just add here, probably if you step back and look at the global, to your point, geography and the politics of the world, if you look at Europe and then you look at India, I feel India is so diverse, it can absorb all of Europe in. And yet we sort of, you know, coexist and have our own, you know, traditions and cultures in each district, town and village as well, right? Language, the cuisine, everything is different and yet so diverse and together. If I take an individual now, so this is Ashok going through, you know, creating a Mythbuster, aware of this is the audience. I'm going to do my research. Here's my study and this is my opinion and point of view. Now, if I take that as Ashok in every home, because when you're going through personal transformation, it's an Ashok in every home. And this audience that you're talking about is in every home, right? Yes. To our point about validation. Is there a framework, methodology, or tool you can provide to an Ashok in every home that allows them to A, go identify the myth, B, do the groundwork, C, identify how my storytelling has to be, with who as well, who matters in this, and what are my choice points and decisions that I will, and consequences to it as well, right? Because you need to probably, when you're going through change, like if I just take a home, a methodology, tool, framework, we can give back to someone watching this, going through personal transformation, saying, you know, this has worked for me, maybe worth trying.
I think it has to start with the humility that you will likely fail, meaning that you're likely to not change too many people's minds, right? So therefore, I think going at it as here's my end goal in mind, and I'm going to spread the gospel of my transformation. I'm going to change everyone's life. I'm going to bust myths, and I'm going to make people more rational. I'm going to make them eat healthy, not believe in these things, be more scientific. I think that's the wrong way to go about it, right? I think it has to start from that. You have to be okay with failure. Right. And the second thing is many of the things that I mentioned. One is that in general, what I find is that children are often the best at being curious and at being uninhibited about asking questions. It's just that then we beat the curiosity out of them. Right. Yeah. As we kind of grow up, I think we go from it being acceptable to infer the spirit of things. Right. So kids are naturally good at, you don't do this, they're naturally good at finding a path around it, very creatively so, right? Just like the way, you know, my son once sort of, you know, referred to the Statue of Liberty. He was describing it to me and he said, what does the Statue of Liberty hold? And he said, ice cream. And since then, I've never been able to think of the Statue of Liberty as holding anything other than an ice cream, right? So yeah, so it's it's sometimes tempting to think I have to correct it. No, it's actually a torch. And I'm like, no, I think a torch is not an improvement over an ice cream. An ice cream is actually fundamentally better. So that's it. I think there has to be a free-spiritedness where you actually appreciate that kind of a child's way of just freely thinking about the world and asking questions and being skeptical and so on. And then I think building that habit of being able to then answer in a way that a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old or a 9-year-old can understand, right? And being able to have that patience, right? You've got to have the same patience when you want to explain to people, right? You can't just beat them down at their beliefs for it. So you have to be able to get down to their level. Why do they believe what they believe? And you have to have a deep understanding of this fact that people are not wedded to beliefs. They're actually wedded to the community of people who share that belief, right? So, you know, often I sometimes a relative of mine used to be a teacher and all of that. Now she's 70 years old in a WhatsApp group and so much misinformation being spread, and she's forever sort of, you know, participating in that. And I would often say, look, you know, you used to be a science teacher and now people are sharing all of this complete unscientific nonsense. Why aren't you fact checking? And he says that, look, you know, the point is that I don't believe or not believe, my belief in this is immaterial at all, right? If I say that doing this particular ritual is unscientific and I'm not going to participate in it, I lose my identity in this group, right? And just because I show off my avowed, you know, rationality and all of that, am I getting another group to be part of? Not necessarily. It's not like my children and all my other NRA, all these younger kids are now suddenly going to embrace me as one of theirs. I need to be part of this group, right? So at the very least, I might not just question, right? It's just going to, these are just old people and their beliefs. I'm just going to quietly accept it. So you have to also recognize that a lot of people hold these beliefs because those beliefs equal to identity. And if changing that belief means losing that identity, they will not change. And you've got to be aware of that. At the very least, you've got to be able to give them an alternative identity. You've got to somehow convince them that there's a way to do this without losing your identity. And you've got to be very, very... So I think in that sense, you have to think very, very sort of deeply, right? I mean, as a corporate person, you know that hardest things about change management is not the stuff that you put in the PPT, right? Yeah. It's dealing with the guy who might lose his job as the result of automation 10 layers down, right? Yeah. So it is... And that is not what's reflected in the presentation that you make.
Chris, this was beautiful in how we went through debunking, the process of debunking myths. And I think if I hold a parallel mirror to the process of personal transformation, and the last one, especially where you talk about the methodology or the framework, it really shows why change is so difficult, isn't it, on a personal level. It really calls out the innate nature of human beings and why is change so difficult. So first of all, thank you for that. These are some things that I normally do with my guest as well. One of the things is when all societal labels vanish, to your point about identity and individuality, it's a big part of who we are. And when you're going through change, that's what you're trying to change as well, right?
Yeah.
Who stands before us then becomes a question. So if I strip off every title, every association that is out there that I've seen in the digital space about you, who is Chris? Who is Ashok?
My view of, for example, why I have a software career, for example, is that it's the most amount of money for the least amount of work. It's a lighthearted way of putting it, but it's also a discipline that allows and encourages being incrementally more and more productive and freeing up more time for yourself. Right? You're making a car, you're doing something else, you don't have flexibility of time as much as you do in software. The most productive software engineer is order of magnitude more productive than the least software engineer. And so there's always more improvement that you can squeeze out of and find yourself more time. So in that sense, my choice of career has always been about, can I find myself more free time to do the things that I want to do? Right? So that's one level of this. The second level of it is that software thinking mindset is what I bring to music or to cooking and all of that. The whole first principles, spend less time, be more productive, be more creative sort of thing. And I also, one of the things I keep telling people is that people think Masala Lab, I must be, how do you balance IT job and being a celebrity influencer and all of that? I said, no. The truth is that the net amount of time that I spend making content on Instagram is 40 minutes a week. That's 20 minutes a video. My skill is storytelling. It's not video production, fancy stuff. I don't do fancy animation, zoom, this. That is not those are sort of, you know, ways of covering up bad storytelling, right? And so if you have a good script, then you just need to turn on the camera, speak, and that's all you need to do, right? And that really takes only 20 minutes from start to finish. And so it's two videos a week is what I do. But the algorithm shows it to everyone all over the time. It makes it seem like I am all over all the time. No, I only spent 40 hours on the weekend making these. That's all I did, right? So that's not my identity as well. So software is not my identity, not music, not any of this, right? So I do all of this so that I can maximize the amount of time that I can spend with my wife and kid and my home, right? So that is the end goal. The more amount of time that I spend playing with my son, you know, studying with my son and doing these things with him, and cooking for my family and making something for my mother-in-law, for my mother, and taking them out, and that is all the rest of this is primarily designed to feed that.
Yeah.
The more I do of that, the better, right? More I can take them on vacations, right? Getting a good job, more money, so I can take them to better places, and so on. So I think that is me.
That's beautiful. And I think this is something which we talk about a lot, which is, you know, when we talk about work-life balance, it's normally looked at as one at the cost of another. What you really brought out beautifully is I cannot decouple the two. It's one for me. And so it's about how I balance. So time is your currency. And therein lies everything that you're doing as well over here.
It's not work-life balance. It's a work-life continuum.
Absolutely.
You figure out where you draw that. And sometimes, there will be times when it is hard, right? That's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But if you take a longer picture view and then make strategic choices that nobody's worried about whether you're there for a week, for a day, even for a month.
Yeah.
But over a five-year period, how many vacations did you take your family on? How many movies did you go out to? How many times did you eat out? And how many times did you have dinner together? That stuff adds up, right? It's not, right? So I think sometimes people individually fail to take that personal big picture view at all, and instead get stuck in the weeds. Right?
That's so true, so true. My last one, reflecting on this conversation that you and I had, how would you describe Attitude Makeover?
Attitude Makeover is... I think our attitudes are sort of like the surface manifestation of decades and years of experiences, both subconscious, conscious, beliefs, heuristics, some that you know, some that are unconscious that you don't even realize are operating. And then all of that experience, right? And then all of that surfaces up, and then what people see is your attitude. You're confident, you're not confident, you're brash, you're arrogant, you're all of that, the surface stuff, right, is basically hiding a ton of layers. And I really think you can't change the surface. It's just like changing the icing on a cake, right? I think you really have to do the uncomfortable job of digging underneath and really get to why people behave the way they do. Like, for example, the person was so nasty and angry about me promoting Nonstick.
True. Well, I thank you so much. This has been, I hope you found this as interesting as...
It was good. It's always good to see, interesting, thought-provoking questions, right? Otherwise, it's just, I'll end up on podcast where they'll ask me, is Bengen safe to eat? Is it, why? And so on. It's good.
Yeah, I'd love to meet you. I'd love to host you for lunch. I'm a hardcore carnivore, but with IBS, it's very limited food these days. So, but I'd love to host you.